Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh, and we're broadcasting this hour from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. It is the Brown Bag Book Club, and we have Professor John Schaff with us. You know him from the Dakota Political Junkies. He's a political science professor at Northern State University and the author of a new book about Abraham Lincoln. It's called Abraham Lincoln, Statesmanship and the Limits of Liberal Democracy. Dr. Schaff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Do I just get to call you John from now? Because I got the professor, I've got the doctor, I've got the author.
I think you've paid your dues. I think you can go with John.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm reading this book, and as soon as I start, it occurs to me that as much as I have welcomed you on the show in the past, mm-hmm. that I don't necessarily have a grasp of what political scientists do, because I'm reading this book, and I'm like, there is more to it than I ever realized. So for our listeners, give us an idea of what is the work of a political scientist in moving sort of the conversation and the research and the study of some of these issues forward today.
I mean, if I could generalize, you know, and it's a little bit difficult to generalize because there's so many different subfields in political science and different kind of methodologies. Some people study international relations, some people study political theory, some people study particular regions, like the politics of particular regions of the world, even within the field of studying American politics. Some people study the presidency, some people study elections, some people study political parties. But I think generally what political scientists are trying to do is they're trying to gather data. Now, and what data means depends on kind of what subfield you're in. But you're trying to gather data and information to try to find patterns in political activity. That's what political scientists do. It's the study of politics, trying to find patterns, and then explain those patterns to each other as professionals, then hopefully to the general public, whether in books, articles, students in classrooms. And that's what political scientists do. And so the methodology of my book, there's a field of study in political science called American political development. And this came about, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 years ago, this movement sort of started. Because a lot of political science, in fact, the most political scientists are very quantitatively driven. It's collecting data, putting it into regression analysis, spitting out some beta coefficients and standard errors and that sort of thing. And what the American Political Development, or APD as they like to go by, what they try to do, it's the application of really historical methods to political questions. And so I really think that actually American political development and political history, when they're done well, are almost indistinguishable from each other.
All right. Yeah. So with this book, mm-hmm. talk to me about your fascination with President Lincoln. This goes back quite some time.
It does. Well, I was a graduate student, embarrassingly long ago. It's a little over 20 years ago, really. 20 years ago, I was in some ways starting to write this book. And I was going to write a dissertation about something completely different. And the guy who I ended up working with as his graduate assistant, and he ended up becoming the chair of my dissertation committee, Ray Tatalovich, he said to me one time, he said, there's not enough work done in Abraham Lincoln on what we call what I end up calling in this book, the domestic side, the stuff that has nothing to do with commander-in-chief powers. And there's so much written on Lincoln as a commander-in-chief. He said, well, there's nothing really written on the other stuff. And I said, you're right. I should write that. And he said, yes, you should, which was the whole point of him bringing it up. And so I started reading and researching Lincoln as president, leading through, as I'm sure we'll get to, in the Civil War era. Not only was a Civil War fought, there are these really path-breaking pieces of legislation, some of which are very important to our part of the country, things like the Homestead Act. The Land-Grant College Act, the Pacific Railroad Act, all these were passed in the 37th Congress, which is the first Congress of the Civil War, so 1861 to 1863. And then more obscure but very important things, there's a thing called the Legal Tender Act, the National Bank Act, which, as the name suggests, were more economic regulation. So there are these really big pieces of legislation. And so the question was, how does Lincoln act as a presidential leader on these pieces of legislation? And that was my dissertation. But then over time, that's really where the fascination began. The more I read of Lincoln, the more I became interested and just sort of immersed myself in it. And over the a period of time, I just kept writing and writing about it until I said, I probably should throw this all together into a book, which is what I end up doing, obviously.
All right, so you mentioned domestic side of President Lincoln, and the next question is, well, what's more domestic than a civil war?
Exactly.
Right? So you make that distinction in the
book.
Exactly. Well,
because a civil war, even though I call it the domestic Lincoln, I say in the book, I understand a civil war is by definition domestic. Right. That's what puts the civil in civil war. But what I'm really talking about, and this is really the second half of the book, is these sort of non-war, kind of what we would kind of call regular public policy, non-crisis, non-war. And so it's sort of how did Lincoln operate in what we would think of as a more mundane situation than you're prosecuting a war and it's a civil war. So obviously this is really the pivotal moment in American history is the Civil War, but there's other stuff going on. And so that's the point of terming it the domestic Lincoln is I'm really looking at everything that has really nothing to do with foreign affairs or the commander-in-chief power.
Right.
Where everybody recognizes Lincoln was a strong president on that. But that's where the presidents are understood to be constitutionally very strong. So let's look at Lincoln doing non-commander-in-chief.
Right. Everybody activities. Recognizes Lincoln's influence mm-hmm. in the sense that he's almost become a talking point or someone yeah. who's taken for granted. You hear people say the party of Lincoln as a sweeping generalization of who this president was. What's the risk of him sort of becoming so part of our daily dialogue that we lose the nuances of who he was, like our, you say the word stale, like our knowledge of Lincoln has mm-hmm. become stale.
Yeah, because the book actually starts with an anecdote of sorts from the English author G.K. Chesterton, where he talks about the way to know a place is either like live there intimately for a long period of time or travel around the world and come back. So you either have to like know it really intimately or then go someplace completely different so you can compare your home to this completely different place. And so he says, you know, the worst thing is to know it well enough to take it for granted, but not well enough to know it intimately. And sometimes I think this approach to democracy and to Lincoln, that we sort of have this superficial knowledge of Lincoln. And we know like some of the big phrases from the big speeches. So people know like with malice toward none, or we hold these truths to be self-evident. Fourscore and 7 years ago, which is and then these truths are part of the Gettysburg Address. So we know some of these key phrases, but do we investigate him enough to really know what he actually believed and what he did, as opposed to turning him? I quote, you know, Daniel Boorstin, the historian who coined the term "famous for being famous." And so we kind of turn this, not just Lincoln, but various public figures throughout history become sort of celebrities. And so the knowledge is quite superficial. And that's a danger because they became larger than life for a reason. And because we just sort of, you know, it's sort of in our blood, it's the water we swim in. We sort of lose over the course of time this sense of why Lincoln became this giant or any other of our big figures, you know, people carved on Mount Rushmore sort of thing. Why are they on Mount Rushmore? Or has it just become something that we become so used to that we don't even notice it anymore?
Do scholars disagree greatly about him as a statesman? Let's talk about President Lincoln as a statesman. What exactly does that mean? And what are some of the prevalent thoughts on who he was as a statesman?
Yeah, well, I think that there's probably at least two schools of thought. One of my undergraduate teachers used to say there's at least 4.5 positions to everything, but I'll simplify and say two. And I think, and this is sort of one of the things I investigate in the book, and it's a matter of what is Lincoln's relationship with the American founding. And if, as I was saying previously, if the Civil War is really this pivotal point in American history, when people teach American history, partially for chronological reasons, but partly for the import of it, often we break U.S. history into U.S. history up to the Civil War, then U.S. history after the Civil War. Partially because as we sit here right now, it's almost in the middle. Obviously, every year that becomes less true, but it's almost in the middle. But also, I think we recognize that something big changed. And so the question is, was Lincoln more of a preservative character? Was he trying to preserve the best of American founding and defend it? Or was it a refounding? Was the Civil War such a big change, you might even say revolutionary, that you can sort of say after the Civil War and with Lincoln's leadership, America is a different kind of country than it was before the Civil War, with the obvious example of that being the eradication of slavery and the elevation of equality as the central principle. So the question is that reaffirming something that was there at the founding, or is it such a big change that it's something new, that it's a kind of refounding? And then as well as, again, what I investigate to an extent in the second half of this book is also this public policy change. And so there's an historian, Leonard Curry, who called the Civil War Congresses forming what he called a blueprint for modern America. Mm-hmm. And did these public policies I mentioned previously, like Homestead Act, Banking Act, that sort of thing, did these lay the foundation for the Industrial Revolution, which would be the other great revolution then in American history, this path-breaking moment of economic change? Did that start in the Civil War? And so I think that would probably be where scholars are differing, is do you see Lincoln more as someone who is maintaining something or someone who is changing something, more progressive, revolutionary, whatever adjective you want to throw on that?
What side do you fall in? Is he reimagining or is he reasserting?
Well, I think if anyone would read the book, I think you could see I go with the latter rather than the former, the reasserting rather than reimagining. Because I think everything that Lincoln stood for, and here now more so the first half of the book, which is more, if you will, theoretical, Lincoln is standing for natural rights, which is foundational to the American Republic. Thus, you know, from the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So equality is not anything new. He was reaffirming something there at the founding, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's natural rights theory. And these, I think, are the things that Lincoln was primarily defending more theoretically. And so I don't think you need to read Lincoln as breaking with the American founding. I think it's, to this extent, conserving the best of the American founding and trying to apply it to a new situation. I think the way Lincoln conceived of himself is that, as you can see this in the Gettysburg Address, that we are bringing these founding principles to life in a way they never have been, right? The intentions of the founders we can realize to a greater degree than they did. And then even when it comes to public policy, as I say, it's the third chapter in the book, you can trace Lincoln's public policy philosophy directly to Alexander Hamilton, I think. And even at the American founding, there was disagreement about this, right, about how big a government should we have, what role should government have in promoting economic activity, to what extent should we be a mercantile financial banking nation as opposed to an agrarian nation. And that's a split that's there at the founding. Most obviously, you could put it to personalities between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. And I think with some qualifications maybe we can get to, I think Lincoln is in the Hamiltonian vein. But you can tie that to, as say, a founding father. And I don't think Lincoln conceived of himself as doing something new, of something path-breaking. And I think that to the extent that we have done things that break with the American founding, those are things that came later in American history.
Can you see that through his actions, or are you also seeing it through his words? Is he quoting certain things? Is he, you know, going back to, certain foundational documents?
Well, the
obviously the foundational documents that he goes to primarily are the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution. So he famously said that the Constitution is the frame of silver that frames the golden apple of the Declaration of Independence. He stole that from the Book of Proverbs. That was not as he was wont to do, quoting scripture. It's a reference to the Book of Proverbs, that the golden apple of the American Republic is the Declaration of Independence. What he called at various times the axioms of democracy are found in the Declaration of Independence. And here's where you see Lincoln praising Thomas Jefferson. And there's a speech that he gave on the train, where he was doing various stops in various cities on the way from Springfield to Washington, D.C. for his inauguration in early 1861, when he said, "All hail to Jefferson." And so I think he saw himself as trying to justify these axioms of American democracy. And then secondly, the Constitution, of a dedication to the rule of law and recognizing constitutional rights. And so a famous early speech of Lincoln in 1839, this speech before the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield, Illinois, which he titled "On the Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions." And that name itself suggests that he's interested in conserving and perpetuating something. And the whole point of that speech is almost a radical defense of rule of law, to the point where he says, even if there's an unjust law, right, we should follow it. And that would be controversial in our day. But he says, as our fathers swore like their blood to the Revolution, so should we swear our blood and our sacred honor to the Constitution of the United States. And I think those are the two documents the founding documents that he goes back to over and over and over. And he uses a language a lot when he gets into the debates with Stephen Douglas in the 1850s. He's always talking about old agreements. Now there he's mostly talking about the 1820 Compromise, the Missouri Compromise, which Douglas had tried to overturn. Well, he did overturn with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, this anti-slavery, largely anti-slavery compromise that Douglas was trying to get rid of on the behest of pro-slavery forces in 1854. And Lincoln talked over and over about preserving old compromises, even to the point in his 1860 speech at the Cooper Union in New York City, where he says, "What is conservative but valuing the old and tried over the new and untried? And if that is conservative, then we are Republicans," he's talking about. "We are as conservative as anybody," because, of course, the attack on them was that they're a bunch of dangerous radicals.
Right.
So there's a bit of rhetorical action going on there. He's trying to position himself as, "I'm not crazy." But he said, what we're doing is we're trying to defend the American founding and defend old compromises. We're not doing anything new.
We're going to have more with John Schaaf talking about President Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln's Statesmanship is the book, and you're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. We'll be back after a break. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today for the Brown Bag Book Club from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in SDPB Sioux Falls Studio. My guest is the author of the new book, Abraham Lincoln's Statesmanship and the Limits of Liberal Democracy, John D. Schaaf, who is a professor of political science at Northern State University, a frequent guest on In the Moment. And you mentioned, John, before the break, this radical defense of rule of law.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the part in the book where I have all kinds of highlights and questions and really, and what? And what is that? Because you said it's hard to get your mind around now.
Yeah.
Was it hard to get your mind around then? Sort of this concept of rule law, to the point where he is talking about the legitimate legal rights of slaveholders. Mm-hmm. Well, today that doesn't really sound like a legitimate legal right to own another human being. The brutality of the slave business we know so much about. So did they.
Yes.
Help us understand this part of Lincoln.
I think there's two things. One, the rule of law. I know. I remember the first time I ever read the speech I referred to a little bit, the perpetuation of our political institutions speech. I was an undergraduate, and what my professor did when we read this, and this is quite common. In fact, I will be doing this with my own students this fall, is you read it alongside Henry David Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, or sometimes people will read it alongside the letter from a Birmingham jail from Martin Luther King, a defense of civil disobedience. And that's one of the things that maybe rings a little bit off, because we have such a rich history in our day of just civil disobedience, of people refusing to follow unjust laws and bringing about good from that. I think what Lincoln is getting at, part of it is historical, is that, and I mentioned this in the book, this was a time when mob rule wasn't a crazy threat. There were riots, there were political riots, there was a lot of political agitation, and the sense that the mob was going to get out of hand was live. And so Lincoln, you might say, erred on the other side of that, saying, no, we have to have rule of law, we have to have order. And this is, of course, one of the essential truths, I think, of politics, is that maybe people don't appreciate, is that order is very difficult to create and very easy to break. and so Lincoln is saying we have to maintain this public order. And so this dedication to the rule of law, to the Constitution, is so important, because if we lose this idea of rule of law, or what today we might call due process, right, then what, and it's part of, you know, the second half of the title of the book about the limits of liberal democracy, is that, and this dovetailing this, the second point about that, is that part of what being a statesman is this idea that the first substantive chapter of the book is these virtues of prudence and moderation. And part of what being a moderate statesman is, I define moderation, I'm stealing from Aristotle, so it's not like it was my definition, but is having each good thing in its proper amount. And in a democracy, there are various good things that we're trying to enhance. Things like, what are our values? We value liberty. We value equality. We value rule of law. We value due process. We value consent of the governed. But all those things have to be balanced, because we know sometimes those things enter into conflict. So in this case, what if what the people want is fundamentally unjust, right? What he's talking about in the speech, the Lyceum speech. What if what the people want is fundamentally unjust? Or what if they try to achieve a just thing, but in violation of the law? This if you get into the habit of the law is too slow, the law gets in our way, the next thing you know, you've got a mob, right? And the rule of law is there precisely to constrain consent and majority rule, that you get what you want, but only if you follow a preordained process. With the rights of slaveholders, what Lincoln was saying is that if the abolitionists, William Lloyd Garrison famously said, no union with slaveholders, right? And the U.S. Constitution, is a blood contract, because it gave certain winks and nods to slavery, even though the word slavery is not in our U.S. Constitution. Even when slaves are referred to in the U.S. Constitution, they're referred to as persons. Not as slaves, because literally the person who wrote the U.S. Constitution, Gouverneur Morse, like literally head of the Committee on Detail in Philadelphia, was anti-slavery.
Yeah.
And he made sure the word slavery did not appear in our Constitution. But there are certain protections in there for slaveholders. And Lincoln said, if we're going to get rid of slavery, it is going to be done by a process, right? Either through compensated emancipation, like it or not, this is property which is protected by the rule of law. So if the government is going to take your property, it has to compensate you. So maybe we pay people to get rid of their slaves. Or what the position he ended up getting to is he sort of sensed that the arc of history, if you will, was bending towards freedom. And if we can isolate slavery where it currently was in the South and not allow it to expand, it will eventually die out, right? That the pro-freedom people were, and this is part of why we get the Civil War, is they were outnumbering the pro-slave states, right? It's part of the reason the South seceded is I think they saw the writing on the wall, that if they stayed in the Union, the institution was not going to last. It just didn't have the support of the majority of the American people, so they had to set out on their own. But if we start violating the law, even for very just reasons, it teaches a bad lesson, which is that we should just simply get whatever we want. And sometimes what we want is not a good thing.
So then some of those compromises are creating the scenarios with the Fugitive Slave Act, for example, mm-hmm. where we had Andrew Del Banco on the show recently mm-hmm. who had written a book about the Fugitive Slave Act. And he was talking about, in his work, judges who would stand from the bench and order an escaped slave who had been mutilated, and all the people had seen this, they were disturbed by it, it was in their face, would order that person back to his owner and then go home and hide, you know, a fugitive mm-hmm. slave in his own, you know, bedroom. So you have people making these moral decisions, wrestling these two things together. Was Lincoln stalling? Was industrialization, and is he getting ready for the fact? Does he know that at some point this is going to be a military battle and the North needs to win?
No, I don't think that's the case in the 1850s, because I think what he's trying to do, and this is part of the fight between Stephen Douglas and Lincoln, is what is the most likely way to avoid war? Because people sort of sensed mm-hmm. what was coming. And for Lincoln, it was this policy of non-extension, as he called it. Why was he so upset with Douglas? Is Douglas, his bill of 1854, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, had overturned the Missouri Compromise, which said north of the parallel of, 34 degrees 50, it's the southern border of Missouri. Everything north of that, as part of the Louisiana Purchase, was to be free. They're supposed to be, with Missouri being the one exception to that, when it entered in the Union in 1820, everything north of that parallel would enter the Union non-slave, right? But the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 overturned that. And Lincoln saw in that they're opening the West up to slavery. That's what the pro-slavery people are trying to do. And so he said, here's where I will not compromise, is we cannot compromise with the extension of slavery. And they're the ones who are pushing us towards war by being aggressive, by overturning these old compromises. Whereas Douglas was to say, why can't we just let the people vote of each territory as it comes in as a territory and then a state? Why can't we just let them vote whether they're a slave state or a non-slave state? And that's how we will avoid war, right, is by just letting the people decide. And even right up to the Civil War, you know, as Lincoln became president, he told people the one thing I will not, as people were looking at various compromises, the one thing I will not compromise on, there will be no extension of slavery into these Western territories. And this is where it stops. But I think what people maybe don't appreciate is it's easy from the point of view of where we are today to look back at the injustice of slavery. And I think one of the things Lincoln is getting at is not only legal rights. If we're going to get rid of slavery, it's going to be through, as I say, compensated emancipation, let it die on its own, or, as ended up happening, an amendment to the Constitution, right, which obviously he supported, and no, Steven Spielberg made a whole movie about it, that he supported, that you have to do it through a constitutional amendment if you can actually eradicate slavery. But we have to follow these processes, right? And I think what we sometimes, from our day, partially because we take these processes for granted, I don't think we see how tenuous democracy can be. And that even, you know, you see this from the American founding, even amongst anti-slavery people. How do you get rid of slavery? It's not as easy as we just get rid of, okay, now you've got millions of freed slaves. Now what are you going to do? Right? And that was part of that's why there was a history of colonization. Well, we should colonize them back to Africa. That was one solution. How do you integrate these people who have been enslaved for 200 years back into civilization. And it's not as easy as it sounds. And that's one of these things that they struggled with, is legal questions and even practical questions of what do we do with this institution mm-hmm. that we've built a whole society around, at least part of our society, and if you got rid of it overnight, what exactly would happen?
Talk a little bit about who he is as a president, in the sense that what we can learn today, when we are in an era of every presidential tweet, or the era of the executive order, when you look at some of the things President Obama was criticized for, President yep. Trump was criticized. We look at the contemporary president and we say this is the power and the influence and the celebrity that our presidents mm-hmm. have. Was that who he was domestically? How was he different from, how did he see that role of executive yeah. leadership versus congressional
yeah.
leadership?
One of the biggest differences, I think it's one of the lessons of the book, is that Lincoln's conception of the presidency was far more modest than our conception. Part of that, I think, was him. Part of it was the era. The era had a very different idea of what a president's role should be. And so even though we think of Lincoln as this great president, which he was, right, and as a very powerful president, the whole point of when I was talking about public policy earlier is that outside of the commander-in-chief power, Lincoln largely deferred to Congress. One of the little tidbits I found when researching the book, a little stat I came up with, is that someone calculated that in Lincoln's 4+ a little bit more years as president, he gave about 100 public speeches, right? In Barack Obama's first term, he gave close to 2,000 public speeches, 700 of which, literally 699 of which, were formal enough that he used a teleprompter, right? And that's a very different conception of the presidency, the president being of this very public figure that everybody looks to explain what's going on, to lead. And the point about those public policies is that on the whole, even though these were major pieces of public policy, like Homestead Act, Land Grant College Act, Lincoln was almost completely deferential to Congress. He seldom spoke about public policy that was being debated in Congress. He didn't really have much of a legislative agenda outside the Civil War. He didn't really lead Congress in any way, shape, or form, because it was understood at the time, their conception was that the presidency was not a representative office. The country is far better represented by Congress, which can represent the diversity of the United States. And the president's job is largely to enforce what Congress does. And the idea of a president speaking out in public about public policy being debated in Congress was unheard of. In fact, this is one of the articles of impeachment against Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, was attacking Congress, like naming names. This is something that President Trump did. He's probably done it 5 times today. Naming somebody in Congress and attacking them,
yeah.
right? Or even taking a position on a bill which Congress is debating was considered verboten. And Lincoln abided by these conventions. So he engaged in almost no legislative leadership and very little public leadership. He didn't really give grand speeches, even though the State of the Union.
Except the ones that he did.
What we know of, like of his public speeches, about this, is there's exactly 3 of them.
Yeah.
His first inaugural, second inaugural Gettysburg Address. And in 4+ years as president, there are 3 major speeches, right? There are a handful of, but most of his public speeches are labeled in his collected works as remarks, right? Because they're a paragraph, yeah. right? But aside from these 3 things, he's seldom spoke in public, even though now we have every year, annually, we have the State of the Union TV show that we do. Lincoln, in the convention with his times, wrote a letter to Congress. No speech, right? Here it is, deliver it by, and then it was read in Congress.
Right.
So largely deferential to Congress, even though these speeches we talk about, there's not a mention of public policy in one of them other than war policy. In fact, at the beginning of his first inaugural, Lincoln says words to the effect, I'm not going to talk about things that, these mundane matters of public policy. Let me just talk about secession. And that's what he talks about for almost the entire speech. These other things aren't worth talking about. Things like You know, should we have a higher tariff? What should our tax policy be? What should our land policy be? I'm not even going to talk about those things. I'm going to talk about this one thing, and that's it.
We'll take a break. We'll be back with more with John Schaaf on the Brown Bag Book Club today on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking this hour with Professor John Schaaf from Northern State University. His new book is called Abraham Lincoln's Statesmanship and the Limits of Liberal Democracy. And I want to make sure we get to some of these domestic policies that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, the Homestead Act, the Land Grant and College Act. These are things that really are influencing us still today. Mm-hmm. Start with the Homestead Act and tell us a little bit about, where Lincoln stood and how that transpired historically.
Yeah, well, the Homestead Act was something that was in some sense a long ways coming, as late as the 1840s. You know, people looked at all this land that the government owned out in what would they have then called the West, what we now call the Midwest mostly, and said, what can we do with this? And so the idea that you could either give or essentially give that away to settlers and people could come out and farm it, starting in the 1840s and started really take hold in the 1850s. It was controversial only because largely Southerners opposed the Homestead Act because they were afraid of the West becoming populated too quickly. Therefore, those territories would become states and they would probably be free states. For one thing, most of those were part of the Missouri, before the Kansas-Nebraska Act, most of this territory was part of the Louisiana Purchase. And slavery could legally not take hold. And the assumption was the kind of farming that was going to take place and what the place like Dakota Territory, what is now South Dakota, would not be the kind of labor-intensive farming that was conducive to slavery. And this, I think, they were probably right, that slavery wasn't going to take hold here. But this is what populates a lot of what we call, now the Midwest or the Great Plains, whatever you want to call this area of the country. Is the government saying we've got all this property for a low, low price? Here you are,
and we should say it's already populated.
Yeah, well, yes. With
I want to make sure that you get a chance to clarify that there's people here
with native populations, mm-hmm. but I'm talking obviously white settlers. So mm-hmm. I should say settlers coming and settling the territory, and so this is. This is huge for this part of the country because it's what settles it with white settlers, with homesteaders, and kind of what makes what I'll call the Great Plains the Great Plains and populates it with people coming from the East.
Do we see evidence of him processing that, the people who lived here, with the people that he was opening up to settle the land? Do we see evidence of that?
Well, I think
he thinks about slavery very deeply, and he speaks about slavery in ways that are still controversial, but does he speak about indigenous populations? Does he have relations with tribes? What is his knowledge of opening up this, in quotations, opening up this land for white settlers?
I think you can say this. Actually, when he was younger, this is more in the 1840s, there was a movement in the United States, which is essentially the Manifest Destiny movement, but it was called the Young America Movement. And one of the leaders of the Young America Movement was Stephen Douglas. And this was very much an ideological movement of America deserves the entire continent, and we're going to spread our influence over the continent, and we're going to extend, quote-unquote, freedom, whether the people who live there like it or not. And this is part of, for example, the Mexican-American War is coming out of this idea that we want this land, and if we have to sort of gin up a war against the Mexicans to take some of this land, we will do so. Well, it's not an accident that Lincoln was opposed to the Mexican-American War and was opposed to Young America and the Manifest Destiny movement. But I think you can say, I'm thinking that up until it becomes present, Lincoln's... The number of words you might say that he writes or utters about Native Americans is almost zero. Obviously, as president, he has to deal with Native American issues and add Native Americans to the White House. And of course, we might talk about the massacre in what is today Mankato, Minnesota, occurred during the Civil War, 1862, if memory serves. That's 1862. But you might say there's really no consideration of what how Western settlement is going to affect indigenous populations. The assumption is that here's this land, the United States government owned the land, we're going to do something with that to settle it with white settlers, and this is, you know, the free soil movement of the 1840s, 1850s.
Property. Like before we were talking about slave owners and property rights, now we're back to... Yep. And you do write in the book about the hanging of the Dakota 38. You talk about his careful examination of evidence against Native Americans sentenced to death after massacres in Minnesota demonstrates his devotion to the moderating effect of the rule of law.
Yeah.
So when that story is told and people are thinking about the Dakota 38 hanged, mm-hmm. many of whom were innocent, mm-hmm. you say what about Lincoln's impact that decision?
So you've got this massacre and you've got a number of natives rounded up, if you will, and they charged dozens upon dozens. And in fact, the number may be in there, might be in a footnote, I can't remember, but I want to say it's well over 100 were convicted and sentenced to death. And what Lincoln did is he went through the records of every single person who was convicted and sentenced to death, native I'm talking about, and he went through the court proceedings and tried to see, was this a regular court proceeding? And the vast majority of those people who were convicted and sentenced to death, he ended up commuting their sentence. The way, you know, it's not like we need to apologize for Lincoln, though. Yeah, I think you'd have to understand that as president during the Civil War, there's a large deference to the military court. And
that's the criticism, that those trials were jokes, or there was no due process.
Which is why, like I say, and that's why he commuted the sentence of most of those people, because it was obvious in those cases that due process was not followed, and he commuted. I'm going to say,
over 100, because I don't see it in the text.
I'm almost sure it's over 100 sentences were commuted, right? And he left the 38 that he thought there was enough evidence there that he didn't feel like he could overturn the tribunal. He didn't have the evidence. Obviously, he wasn't there at the trials, and he felt like there's not enough here to commute the sentences. It was the same thing that he often did with deserters. People were sentenced to death for desertion. His preference was to commute their sentences and to let them go, because unless there is compelling evidence, he... erred on the side of compassion instead of enforcing the sentence. If he could find a legal reason to let somebody off the hook, he would generally take that legal reason to let somebody off the hook. And that's the dedication, I think. What I mean by a dedication to rule of law is that even in something that, you know, if you look back to the times, I mean, compare him to, you know, a generation previous, and Andrew Jackson, who wouldn't have cared a whit about Native rights. At least he took the time to look through. Imagine in the middle of the Civil War, he's pouring through court records of a massacre in Minnesota of Native Americans, and he took the time to do that. And if injustice still occurred, and certainly it did, the injustice was on the ground with the army tribunals, not back in Washington, D.C., in my view, with Lincoln. Because it's probably expecting more of a present than especially, you know, in 1862. It's not like the records are scanty, right? Mm. It's probably more than we can expect for him to know everything that's going on there.
When we look at our time today, and you asked this in the beginning of the book and lay out different responses to it throughout, does Lincoln speak to us across time? And if so, how are some of those key measures that you think he does so with his
presidency? Yeah, I think the book starts out, as I said when I was talking about a while ago, about that Chesterton quote. The central motivating impetus behind the book is the sense that we take democracy for granted. As I say, that we're so used to it, and our democracy has been so successful, that we sort of think that democracy is the natural state of things, that it doesn't need cultivation, it doesn't need taking care of. But what I'm trying to show in the book is that democratic habits, democratic mores need a kind of cultivation. And it's the role of the statesman to do that, to remind the people of certain values, certain mores, certain goods that we're trying to achieve in democracy. And oftentimes what that takes is for democracy to limit itself. And so there is the old saying, vox populi, vox dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. Well, that's obviously not true. It's sometimes the voice of the people, democracy, is unjust. And so the role of the statesman is to remind the people through the things that I talk about, that there's a rule of law. Whatever we do has to be done through rule of law. Whatever government does, it has to do within limits. We have limits like natural rights. There are just certain things that are naturally unjust, like slavery. And even if we want them, we can't get them justly. And Lincoln is the statesman par excellence in American history. And I think in a time when we're very anxious about our democracy and we seem to be at each other's throats a lot, I think maybe this is the time to go back to what is probably our greatest statesman and say, what lessons can Lincoln give us? And we as a people, and maybe those in public office, those who aspire to be statesmen themselves, what lessons can we learn from that? Because it seems like we're doing a pretty poor job of cultivating statesmanship in our republic in 2019. And so maybe it's time to go back to, as I said, the statesman par excellence and look at some lessons.
Yeah. Do we want a statesman in the White House is one of the key questions. Is that what voters want? As we're upcoming, you have like 30 seconds to sort of give us a pithy point to close on.
Yeah,
but
well,
as we're going into an election, you know, we see, is that what voters are going to respond to?
I would say
to?
That there are many incentives within our electoral system against finding statesmen, because our electoral statesmen, or our electoral process is set up precisely to ramp up emotion, ramp up the people, instead of what a statesman is trying to do is to teach us limits. And we don't have much in our electoral system that promotes limits.
Prudence and moderation.
Prudence and moderation.
Back to Aristotle.
Great virtues.
Right.
Exactly.
And there are wonderful ways that one of the things I really appreciated is how you talked about the language that he used and sort of the layers of it as well.
Yep.
The book is called Abraham Lincoln's Statesmanship and the Limits of Liberal Democracy. Professor Dr. John Schaff from Northern State University, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.